Hi there.
Hi, this is Tamsin and Dan of Tamsin and Dan Read the Papers. This is our third episode in our podcast. It's January 29th, 2017.
So, you know, we're getting this going. This is our third one, so we're learning what to do. And we just thought we'd give you a little background on where this idea comes from. And it really comes from WOR. Dan introduced me to WOR about 100 years ago. When would you say? In the early 70s?
100 years ago, the 1870s, yes.
And that was to, because he was trying to impress me with the comic genius of Bob and Ray. Right, Dan?
Yes, Bob and Ray were comic geniuses. I stand by that.
And I had my first job out of college, and I turned on the radio. I was actually the historic interpreter at Washington's Crossing Ferry Museum in New Jersey, in Washington's Crossing, New Jersey. And, you know, I just sat there all day waiting for people to come and pay 25 cents to get the tour of the Washington's Crossing Ferry Tavern. So I had cause to listen to the radio to stay entertained. And I turned on WOR one day, and there were these two people reading the newspaper, Ed and Pegeen Fitzgerald, and it cracked me up. Just two people, older people, in their Fifth Avenue apartment.
Well, they're a couple.
Right?
Yeah.
Reading the newspaper.
Reading the newspaper.
On the radio.
Can't do better than that. So that's what we're doing.
And it turned out there were other shows like that, too. Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick. Dorothy Kilgallen and her husband. Richard Calmore, something like that, an actor. So anyway, so the goal here is just reading the newspaper, picking up on things that interest us, and
commenting on it.
Yeah, yeah. Not everything. We're not going over every bit of news,
right? But we're commenting on it and giving everyone a deeper appreciation of what the papers had in mind, or
well, we
should
hope,
have had in
we
mind.
We hope it's an appreciation.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so. It's, we're having a wild weekend, not really. We're having a relaxed weekend. We went to the movies.
That's true. Yes, we saw 20th Century Women.
20th Century Women, yes.
Yes, exactly.
And,
Yes, it was only fair. The Times actually gave that a good review to bring us back to the newspaper. It wasn't that good. It was, some of it was good. Annette Bening's extremely good. Yeah. Very, very strong characterization. And you might even say the movie might be described as four characters in search of a movie script because they kind of meandered around. And at several points, you thought you knew what the movie was about, but then it seemed like the director kind of gave up on that idea and tried something else. What was illuminating was Tamsin heard an interview with the director before we saw it.
Okay, well, I don't want to go deeply into this, but...
But it was, he was writing, it was a movie about his mother.
It was basically autobiographical.
But that's a problem. Anybody makes a movie about his mother is a movie you don't want to see.
All right, moving right along. And another movie we're not going to see is apparently A Dog's Purpose.
Dog's Purpose, with the Times described in a burst of candor as dreck, a word that they don't use often, particularly in the first paragraph. But what seemed to... energized the Times' negative review more than anything was that it took an irresponsible approach to the care and feeding of dogs. In other words, it suggested to young children that dogs don't have to be taken care of by children, that dogs take care of children, which they thought would be terribly confusing.
Okay, so we're not going to see that. All right, but what we are going to see, actually, is The Liar. We're going to go see The Liar. Got a we talked about that in the previous episode. And trans adaptation, as they call it in one of the reviews, by David Ives of The Liar by Corneille, being put on by Classic Stage.
Yeah, when was that written? Do you remember? Something, several hundred years ago. And that's why you need a trans adaptation.
Well, it was in French.
It was in French, but it was also historical. And we've seen... plays by Feydeau, and I know there are other plays by Molière, which are considered comic masterpieces. And strangely enough, sometimes when they're transmogrified this way, they are comic masterpieces. So we'll see.
Transmogrified?
That's the right
transmogrified?
Word.
Transmogrified?
That's the correct word.
Really? Seriously?
That's the French.
Okay, well, moving right along
in the original
here.
French,
okay.
Yes.
I'm not going to tell you what the play is about because it doesn't sound that compelling. But
well, next
as
week.
Daniel said.
Next week, we'll
yeah,
know.
Yeah, we'll know. But this is what the review says. This may just be his most, meaning David Ives, most brilliant act yet of Franco-American theatrical resurrection. So we will be there.
We have high hopes.
Saturday night.
Well, because we saw Venus.
Get a ticket.
We saw Venus in Fur, which was fantastic.
We've said that.
Right. And if this compares with that, it's fantastic.
Okay, but speaking of liars.
Okay, well, what's interesting is the way that the Times headlines the review for the play with Playing Alternative Facts for Laughs. And anyone who's been reading the Times and following things knows that the Times is making a not very remote reference to the Trump administration and the use of the phrase alternative facts. And alternative facts has sort of set the Times hair on fire to the point that there has been some controversy here. The Times wrote an article during the week where the headline was, "Meeting with Top Lawmakers, Trump Repeats an Election Lie." And that was in a reference to Trump claiming that, in fact, the popular vote was rigged and there were many illegal voters that added to the numbers for his opponent, Hillary Clinton. And this caused a controversy because of the phrase, Trump repeats an election lie. And it's a controversy that was written about in many places, including the New York Times during the week. I mean, does that make sense for the Times to report that Trump is lying as opposed to just saying, Trump continues to contend that, in fact, the election results were somewhat rigged or somewhat inflated votes for Hillary Clinton? That's the way the normal headline would read. Well, in fact, even as reported by the Times, the idea of saying Trump's lying is really kind of off base. I mean, it's terribly off base. Even as the Times writes about it, what NPR says is that if you look in the definition of lie in the dictionary, it's a false statement made with an intent to deceive, intent being the key word. Without the ability to peer into Donald Trump's head, I can't tell you what his intent was. I can tell you what he said and how that squares or doesn't square with the facts, but not his intent. So the Times is kind of out there on an island here. They're the only ones who know what's in Trump's head, and of course they don't. And the problem that goes beyond the Times is really getting it wrong in terms of the use of the English language. Again, NPR says, the minute you start branding things with a word like a lie, you push people away from you. The inherent risk, he suggested, was that news organizations would soon be seen as taking sides. The Times' response to this in its own article, was either totally non-responsive, where they said, well, this is kind of an important thing we're talking about, which is Trump lying. And to be perfectly frank, in the last few months of the elections and the weeks since Trump was elected, there are a lot of the Times articles that might fairly be described as, you know, Trump, the jerk, continues to do jerky things. That's not right. The Times is losing credibility, and I think the point that the NPR is making is that the Times is losing credibility.
All right, so you're basically saying that the Times is not reporting.
That's exactly right.
They're not reporting.
That's
it's
exactly
just like
right.
Liar, liar, pants on fire. And okay. All right. And it's, I guess it caused kind of a firestorm.
Absolutely, say, absolutely. And it's just
with
odd
other
to,
media.
And
yeah.
It's odd to me that the Times doesn't really see it.
All right, well, that's the Times for you.
All right. Well, the next article that we were going to speak out piece about quickly was something from the Wall Street Journal.
Yes. We do read the Wall Street Journal. Our friends, the Walshes, turned us on. We don't read it during the week. I don't read it during the week. Daniel reads it during the week. But on the weekends, the Wall Street Journal has a couple of fun sections, including off-duty. And every once in a while, they interview somebody famous, not a techie person necessarily, but they reveal the technology they use in their lives. And Martha Stewart caught Daniel's eye.
Yes. Well, Martha Stewart, as we all know, is the champion of good things. And her tech essentials are staggering. Now, understood, the Wall Street Journal is the place that you look for a $700 sweater. I mean, there is a different way of looking at the world in the Wall Street Journal. And included in her tech favorites is a drone, the DJI Phantom Vision 2, which you can shoot over a neighbor's property or your own, and as she says, you save the money you would other be paying a surveyor to do the same thing. I'm not sure what she has in mind, but there is a picture of a real drone here, and apparently hers needs some repair. But she finds it an essential piece of tech for her. But there are similar items throughout the article. But the thing that really caught my eye was her writing about her new espresso machine. And
came with the house.
Oh, yeah, I didn't notice that. Did come with the house.
And she thinks it's terrific.
Yeah. And the best part about it is when she writes about it, she says she wasn't really a coffee person, but when she tasted that espresso, it changed her mind. But the capper is this. Now she says in the article, neighbors come for it. Quote, the Clintons once stopped by for a cappuccino. They loved it. You can just imagine the Clintons riding, you know, driving around in upstate New York, thinking of where they might get a cappuccino. One says to the other, perhaps, you know, you can't always count on Starbucks. It's not always the best.
Let's go to Martha's house.
We'll go to someplace. Martha Stewart must be able to make a good cappuccino. She's the, you know, the
Why
professional
not
homemaker.
There?
And of course it works out. So that is how the other half lives, and you can't find out any place but the Wall Street Journal.
Well, and thinking about Martha Stewart, so today in the Times, Martha Stewart, of course, we get a lot of our good recipes from Martha Stewart. Today in the Times magazine section, there was a recipe for chicken by Gabrielle Hamilton, who is the chef owner of Prune in New York City. And, she is actually, we're recording this in New Hope,
Pennsylvania. Oh, she's Jim
Hamilton's daughter,
right?
Yes, yes. She's a local girl, Jim Hamilton's daughter. Jim Hamilton, scene designer, restaurant designer par excellence in the New Hope Lambertville area. But it's a good recipe. But what's interesting about the recipe is it's based on what staff eats in the restaurant before the restaurant opens, called Family Meal. And so that was kind of, seems like a good recipe. It seems like a fun recipe, a stewed chicken recipe. But it also gave a little picture of restaurant work life that I thought was kind of fun. And moving on from that, another nice little sort of personality picture was that in the Metropolitan section. And it's that little blurb that covers what people do on Sundays. And this one's about a poet, and Ron Padgett, who has been living in the same apartment in the East Village in New York since 1967. When they first found the apartment, they were just going to stay there a year, and they've stayed there ever since. And it describes his day, and it's just kind of a charming, poetic day. He gets up, and he has tea and toast. And then a little bit later, he makes a pot of espresso for his wife. And
how old is this guy?
You know what? I can't really tell you that. But he's not. He's no spring chicken.
I see.
I mean, he's and he mentions meeting friends at a restaurant that no longer exists, the Neptune, and how he misses that. It's one of those places, those neighborhood places where you gather. Food's not that good. But that it's not about the food, and it's a real, like, loss.
I'm just hoping he's rent control. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know how this works out.
But and also there was the cute thing about he and his wife are both from Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And when they get to the end of the article, they're telling about how their Sunday ends. And so in Tulsa, you eat dinner at 6 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And he says, they never have gotten over that. They still, no matter what, eat dinner at 6 o'clock, which isn't really the thing in New York. And people will invite them over and they'll say, why don't you come over for dinner? 7:30, 8 o'clock. And he and his wife will say, gosh, we're going to be starving by then. Hmm. So it's just another, you know, little kind of cute character portrait in the New York Times.
Well, it's almost 6 o'clock. We're going to start thinking about dinner. But,
all right.
I'm younger. The,
you know, that's possible.
Yes. Well, all right. So obituaries. We tend to get a lot out of the obituaries. And, of course, the big obituary this week was Mary Tyler Moore.
Well, there was another one before that, another entertainer before that that resonated with us.
Yes.
Maggie Roach.
Maggie Roach of the Roaches.
Yeah. And
if you can imagine having a successful singing group called the Roaches, that's what they had.
R-O-C-H-E-S, three sisters.
Three sisters. Beautiful harmony.
Yeah, actually, you know, I have a Martha Stewart Christmas CD.
And what's the Roaches?
That has a song by the Roaches.
It's all connected.
It's all connected.
And we don't want to jump past Mary Tyler Moore. We're all big Mary Tyler Moore fans, or at least we were at the time, in the appropriate manner. But having said that, it's been a tremendous outpouring of Mary Tyler Moore, perhaps more than I would have expected.
On every manner of media. So, you know, there's no more needed to be said about that.
Right. But there was one other, you know, it's funny. On a similar subject, because Mary Tyler Moore's death elicited a lot of responses about working women, saying how she became the model for how they follow through, and that even includes Oprah Winfrey, and it included other Jane Pauley.
Yeah.
People studied Mary Tyler Moore, but that was a fictional character. It turns out there was a woman named Brenda Barnes who died this week, who I regret to say was a name I was not familiar with. Who in, I'm going to say 1991, was a division head at PepsiCo, a really demanding, high-level job. And at the same time, she had a family with two relatively young children. And in 1991, notwithstanding her involvement in that job, she decided to step down because she was going to put her family first and raise her family.
So she walked away from really high level.
High level. Enormous responsibility, enormous
CEO
money. And what's
PepsiCo
fascinating.
North America.
There are several things that are fascinating about that. One is that, you know, this is an issue that's very, very much front burner today in terms of people balancing careers and women deciding how they're going to balance
life,
family
work
life.
Balance.
Exactly. And like every other big issue, it's sort of approached the newspapers as if it's brand new. This is 1991. And it's not as if this woman was obscure. She was on the Today Show in 1991 talking about her choice. So even though she's sort of forgotten, it was kind of a big deal at the time. But what's also fascinating is the way it played out, and it really resonates if you have children. So what happens when she, in 1991, comes home and says to her family, okay, that's it, I'm sacrificing too much, I'm going to stop working, I'm going to devote my time to you kids, and we're going to move from where we are in Connecticut, which is convenient for me, to our old haunt outside Chicago and restore our family life. The kids do exactly what you'd expect them to do. They say, why are we doing that? Who wants to move? Whose crazy idea is this? We like the program the way it is. So it's real life.
But she does it.
She does it. And yeah. The kids seem to benefit from it. And here's what's interesting. So I think she's almost 9 years out of the workforce. She does come back and get a fairly big job with Sara Lee. That has its ups and downs. But it's sort of a sad story, an interesting story. She has sort of a lesser schedule than she might have pursued if she stayed with PepsiCo. And at the age of 60, she's taking care of herself. She's working out at the gym. And while she's doing that at the gym, she has a stroke at the age of 60. And from that point on, she's in very poor health.
No, she has the stroke earlier than that.
Really?
Yeah, she has a stroke, and then...
Well, at a certain point, here's the point. At a certain point, she really is in poor shape. And what's interesting then is that her daughter, who's in advertising, ends up quitting her job in advertising. This is the daughter that Brenda Barnes had quit for before, now quits her job to stay home and take care of her mother, or until she gets a job as a nurse. But she changes careers just so she has more time to take care of her mother. And which is an interesting symmetry. And then ultimately, of course, it's an obituary. Her mother passes away. And as described here, at the funeral, at the memorial service, the daughter is circulating around telling people that her mother's advice to them would be, don't work too hard. So there's a story that, you know, there's enough in it for anyone who has sort of a political agenda to use for their own advantage as to whether one should quit work or not quit work, or whether one's rewarded for that or not rewarded for that. But again, this is an issue that has been an issue for a long, long time, and I guess will continue to be an issue.
Yeah. Well, it's a sad story.
Yeah. There were two articles that we want to discuss very briefly, which has to do with how people deal with working life as they approach retirement. But one of them is a very upbeat story, and it's a story of Rita Moreno.
Rita is my hero. I saw her in an interview, and she's embarked on a new TV show with Norman Lear.
One Day at a Time, is that it?
Yeah, it's a reboot of One Day at a Time with a Latin family, Latino family, instead of replacing the original. Yeah. And she started shooting that when she's 83. She's 83, and now she's 84.
She's 84, yeah.
Yeah, but she said she was nervous about being able to remember lines. It all came back to her. And she seems terrific, full of energy, full of life.
Yeah, I saw that. You showed me a clip on the Charlie Rose morning show.
Yeah, she sang Happy Birthday to Charlie Rose, a la Marilyn Monroe. And it was really quite charming, quite sexy. I mean, she's my hero.
Well, but she also said, I think you told me that once she got engaged in the show, she just all her alacrity returned, or a lot of it returned. And just by being engaged, she returned.
Use it or lose it.
Use it or lose it is exactly right. Which sort of brings us to the other very interesting, and this is not a downbeat story at all, but it has to do with retirement in some odd way. It has to do with the Big Apple Circus, which is just...
Well, that's kind of downbeat. Well, circus is over.
Circus has filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Yes, that is a downbeat thing, and there's nothing great about that. But having said that, there's a woman here named Jenny Vidbell, who was a circus trainer. And what she did was, after years working in the circus, she decided to retire from the circus, retired to upstate New York, Windham, New York, and took the circus animals with her, or at least quite a few of them. And the thought being that she would use the circus animals for therapy and things like that, and also give the circus animals a place to be more comfortable now that the circus days were over. And the article is quite fascinating, and toward the end of it, they talk about adjustment to retirement. And they make the point that adjustment to retirement is something not only for Jenny Vidbell, but it's necessary for the horses themselves. What they say is that the horses, after they got to Windham, would parade around in tight circles, so much so that they wore a rough path into the grass. The loss of the Big Apple Circus is still acutely felt by Ms. Vidbell and the horses themselves.
So they're still performing. They're still doing their routine.
They can't get out of it. Yeah. They can't get out of it. Yeah. That's what they feel comfortable doing, is still working them through. And it's powerful testimony. And Ms. Vidbell herself is working it through. And her last quote is, "The important thing is that I keep working with them every day. We need the interaction."
We need the interaction. So, I'm worried about retirement.
Right, but it's...
Where are we going to get
it? It's words to live by. Words to live by.
All right. So... Of course, another part of the times I always check out is the meat sheet. That's what I call it. That's what somebody referred to it to me when I was in my 20s. And that's the wedding announcements in the back of the style section. And actually, what's interesting this week is the Times had a little article about the very first wedding announcement, which was in September of 1851, Mr. and Mrs. John Grant, who were in their 20s, and there are photographs of portraits of them. You know, they don't remotely look like they were in their 20s, so I guess people have changed over time. So that was kind of fun, and it's just, and then there was another article about the first Muslim wedding reported in the Times, which might have been actually a fake. It might have been fake news. And the reason for it seems to have been that the Americans at the time were obsessed with Orientalism, obsessed with kind of Asian, Middle Eastern culture. It seemed very exotic. And so people would do things like stage weddings in New York. This was at the Cairo Cafe. And, you know, this was not in 1897, not entirely clear that it was faked, except that at the end of the article apparently reports that The gentleman who was officiating had a lovely long white beard, which he removed after the ceremony.
Wow.
This was very much the thing at the time. There was a mosque set up at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. I mean, it was so fascinating to people. This Middle Eastern culture that people staged it for everybody's entertainment.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's something I just didn't know.
Yeah, it was really a big phase. So speaking of entertainment, the big entertainment next Sunday is in the Abuhoff household will be...
And maybe other households besides would be
perhaps.
The Super Bowl.
Okay.
The Super Bowl.
Or should we call it the big game?
That's right. So I've been encouraged by Ms. Granger to comment on sports.
Even the New York Times doesn't really.
Yeah, we can't do
talk
anything
about sports.
There's nothing. The New York Times is writing about the rodeo or something like that. They're waiting for a big event to come up. But in any event, the sports. So let me just.
So what do you have to say about
a couple
sports?
Minutes in the Super Bowl? Here's what's interesting to me about the Super Bowl.
Besides Matty Ice.
No, well, Matty Ice will figure into this in only a remote way.
Oh, yeah.
Well, here's the deal, and what I think a lot of people who aren't really ordinary football fans don't realize, and I think it's worth keeping your eye on, and that is. The New England Patriots, which is a team which is almost a dynasty, have been close to the championship for each of the last 6, 7, or 8 years, is really a team of cast-offs. Cast-offs. In other words, it's filled with players.
Misfits? Is this Misfit Toys?
Not at all. This is sports, dear. This is serious. So this is cast-offs. Cast-off in the sense that if these players, by now they have some bona fides because they've played with the championship Patriots, but if these players had showed up in their first days at, let's say, the Atlanta Falcons training grounds, they would have been cut.
Okay.
Almost every single player
on the Patriots would have been cut.
But let me prove my point here for a minute, okay, with just a few
Don't
examples.
Don't give me a lot of facts and figures.
I'm going to do it fast.
This is going to bore me to
tears.
No,
it's not. This
I'm
is interesting.
Dozing off.
You can follow this. Chris
my
Hogan.
Eyes are closing.
Chris Hogan. The receiver you'll hear about. I'm going to mention 3 or 4 people you're going to know on
four?
Sunday.
Three or four?
Chris Hogan, okay, is a receiver for the Patriots. Went to Penn State. Sounds like a good football school. Yeah, sure. Except he didn't play football at Penn State. He played lacrosse at Penn State. He couldn't play football at Penn State. He wasn't good enough. He transferred to a small school to play 1 year. Then he was signed and cut by Buffalo, by the San Francisco 49ers, by the Giants, by the Miami Dolphins. Cut, 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 cut.
Yeah.
Then he's on the New England Patriots. The same thing with respect to Rob Ninkovich. You're going to see him released by New Orleans, released by Miami. He's on the New England Patriots. LeGarrette Blount, not drafted, signed as a rookie free agent, released by Tennessee, released by Pittsburgh, playing for the New England Patriots. These are key players. Danny Amendola, signed by Dallas or something.
Yeah,
like,
I get the point.
Waived by Dallas.
I get the idea.
And, you know, people say, well, as long as you got the quarterback. Tom Brady, 6th-round draft choice. You don't make too many teams as a 6th-round draft choice. What the Patriots are doing is staggering. You compare them to the Atlanta Falcons. The Atlanta Falcons, Matty Ice, as Tamsin referred to a moment ago, he's their quarterback. He's very good. 1st-round pick. 4th or 5th pick in the entire nation. Who's his top receiver? Jones. 1st-round pick. Top 10 pick in the entire nation. That's the conventional approach to building a championship football team. All right? Patriots aren't doing that. What does this mean? This means that the coach and management of the Patriots, they're underpaid. It doesn't make some difference what they're getting. They're underpaid. Now, I'm not the kind of guy who loves to talk about what a genius Belichick is, but he's a football genius. And the fact of the matter is, football is a sport that's a coach's sport, much more than it's a player's sport. And that's where the value is in the Patriot franchise. Now, for the winner of the game, which I know Ms. Granger is fascinated to know.
Wait a minute, I don't know what was your point. They play well because they're underpaid?
No. My point is that it's an amazing job by the coaching staff. It's the kind of coaching you haven't seen in 25 years in football or any other sport. It's unprecedented, their ability to develop personnel and to coach up that personnel, which is no small thing in a multi-billion-dollar business.
All right, so a great, you know, coach can create that kind of...
Yes,
can benefit from that kind of chemistry.
Yes, but there are no other exemplars of that. Belichick stands alone. There's nothing even close.
We call it chemistry.
Okay, fine.
When 2 + 2 = 5.
Maybe, but there's no other examples out there. Now, the question is who's going to win the game. I don't know if I want to try to give away the winner because it's going to ruin it.
Who's going to win?
Well, who's going to win the game? Who's going to win the game is actually not that difficult. And the reason, let me jump to it. The Patriots are going to win the game. The Patriots are going to win the game by a lot. Much more than the 4 points. And why do I say that? There are three quick reasons. One is the Patriots have more experience in the Super Bowl. I actually don't think that's that big a factor, though you hear people talking about that.
Okay. Number two
is that you have the defensive team in the Patriots, and the offensive team is the Falcons. And in that kind of situation, the defensive team almost always wins.
Okay.
And number three is you have two teams that are unfamiliar with each other. They haven't played each other in the recent past. That's not always the case. But that's the case between these two teams.
Hmm.
So you have two teams unfamiliar with each other, and they have 2 weeks to prepare with no familiarity. And who does that favor? That favors a team with a better coaching staff. The team with a better coaching staff, that's Belichick. That's the Patriots. Patriots should win easily.
Okay. Can I embarrass myself by saying where is the game?
Game's in Houston.
Houston. Okay. All right. Looking forward to that. Looking forward to the wings and the dips. I'm sure you'll be whipping up.
Yes, I'll be whipping up wings and dips.
Okay. Looking forward to it. And then finally today, we want to just... there was in both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times reviews of a new biography of Margaret Wise Brown, who was the author of
The Good Night Moon. But the biography itself is called what is it called? In the Great Green Room, and which is a play on Good Night Moon, which is often considered her seminal book. But I can tell you in this household, We did read Goodnight Moon to the children. The seminal book by Brown was not considered that one, but Runaway Bunny.
Runaway Bunny. So anyway, the biography sounds somewhat interesting. I mean, the woman had a wild life. She really lived an interesting life. She dies in a kind of extraordinary way.
She does.
And what was that, Dan?
Well, as described here, she died in a gesture of high-spirited defiance after receiving an emergency appendectomy in France. She was asked by a nurse how she was doing. Grand, she replied, giving a can-can kick. It dislodged a blood clot in her leg that swiftly traveled to her brain and killed her at the age of 42.
So that's sad. That's sad.
It's
but
pretty awful.
Back to Runaway Bunny.
Runaway Bunny
is this great book, if you don't know it. And it just is all about a little bunny who tells his mommy he's going to run away. And whatever he's going to do, the mommy bunny will do whatever she can to get him back. I would read aloud to you if we could.
But that would take a long time. How I remember it was each page or two would be the bunny says, "What if I'll do X and Y,"
and
the mother would say, "Well, that won't get you away because I'll do
this
Z
and
whatever."
Yeah,
and so there's no way for the bunny to get away. The mother will always be there.
And at the end,
the way the Thames puts it conceptually, and the person did the review in the Times, I think secretly also prefers Runaway Bunny to Goodnight Moon, and talks about the significance of it. It says, at its heart, the Runaway Bunny is about the desire to be watched over and protected. This, I assume, is why Margaret Etchen ended her Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit with a professor tenderly reading the book to her protege, who lies dying of cancer in a hospital bed. To be forever looked after, what else would we crave when facing the terror of our own impermanence?
It's a book that really captures, I think it's reassuring for kids because it says, no matter what, I'm going to be there for you. I'm going to love you. But it also, for the parent who is reading this book to the child, really captures in a very poignant way the parent's devotion.
But it does. But in a very sensible, regular speaking dialogue way, in a way that a mother might actually talk to her child. And I will let Tamsin close the podcast with, what is the last line?
The last line, which is a great line, is simply, have a carrot. And so, good night. Have some carrots yourself.
Thank you.